Okay, so welcome back. And what I'm going to do today is a little surprise, because we've got an extra paper that I had thought was already very familiar to you here, so I wasn't going to introduce it, but I understand that actually it's not very familiar. And I think you'll find it interesting, even if you'll find it annoying, because it shows a lot of risks in Estonia, but we'll do that later on. It's about household sector debt, house prices, etc. We'll try and fit that in, and Leona will get a copy if you want one as well. It's on the website already, but I just thought that might be a nice, especially since you haven't seen it, it's kind of an illustration of what we're going to talk about in the second lecture anyway, and I'll see how it fits in with the timing. But other than that, we'll just do what I planned, and starting off with the UK financial sector, what I want to do, continuing on the theme of the crisis, but starting a theme of regulation today, is to illustrate some of the issues that are arising now, in particular with what we can call microprudential regulation, regulation of individual banks, the stuff we're familiar with what's been happening in the UK. And the background to this is that I did a paper, a chapter for the OECD on, which is this thing, OECD Working Paper 717, called Financial Stability in the United Kingdom, Banking on Prudence. And this was a chapter in the OECD's UK report, you know, the OECD, like the IMF, do an annual report on member countries. The only thing I wish is that we'd put a question mark after prudence, which makes it a little bit more ambiguous than just the statement. Anyway, you'll have to judge for yourselves what's been happening in the UK. And I'm going to start off at a very basic level, which you'll think, why is he teaching my grandmother to suck eggs? But I think it's useful just to, if we're going to talk about regulation, to remind ourselves of the basics, about banks and their failure. We'll talk about regulation in general, and then the rest is mainly on the UK. Okay, so this is a bank, and basically the reason I'm trying to do this is to remind you of what we're doing in regulation. But also we're going to contrast this, as you see in the second diagram, with what I call a modern bank. And this is very much what economic theorists have always got in mind when they think about banks. This diagram here, they really don't usually think about anything more sophisticated than this. And this is what we might call, a traditional old-fashioned bank, a building society, a savings and loans maybe even, that isn't doing anything particularly exciting. So on the asset side, we've got liquid assets and illiquid loans. On the liability side, we've got a capital and nothing except retail deposits. And just, of course, to introduce financial regulation, traditional financial regulation has been really at least twofold and maybe threefold. So traditional financial regulation said, make sure you've got enough liquid assets to cover the possibility that retail depositors will want their money back, okay? So traditional banks would have quite a fat cushion of liquid assets, and that was designed to protect them against any demand from retail depositors to get their money back. And the second aspect, of course, was capital adequacy that we're still working with, and the idea of capital, among others, I think, is to say, make sure that you can make a certain amount of loss on your illiquid loans before your net worth becomes negative, okay? So capital is designed, of course, to take the first hit if we make losses on our illiquid loans. And what happens if things are not sufficient, if our liquid assets are not sufficient, of course, and we need more funds than to pay retail depositors than we have liquid assets, we have to sell the illiquid loans, and that's what we call the fire sale problem. If you try to sell illiquid loans, everyone assumes that they are the bad ones, they assume there is adverse selection because there's asymmetric information. You can't sell them for their fundamental value, and usually that's the prelude to a bank failure. Now, the interesting point is that whereas economists have very much got that model in mind, banks look a lot more like this nowadays. And we've already talked about a lot of these things yesterday, but I just think it's important to highlight it, really. So what are we saying here? We've still got capital. We've still got retail deposits, but as I was saying yesterday, banks decided that they wanted to grow more than the retail deposit base would actually allow. It's not easy for a bank to increase retail deposits if they want to grow the balance sheet. So what did they do? They grew wholesale deposits, not as a temporary source of liquidity, but as a fundamental source of funding. And as we know, that was a huge aspect of this current crisis. Wholesale deposits are very unstable. HBOS, RBS, and many other banks suddenly found that they'd gone, and then they needed rescuing. On the asset side, the liquid assets have shrunk, and you saw that table, that chart I showed you from Bank of England yesterday. And that's partly because the regulators weren't really insisting on liquid assets anymore. They were so focused on capital that they forgot about liquidity, in my opinion. There are still illiquid loans, but due to securitization, there are also illiquid securities on the balance sheet. We're assuming liquid assets are cash assets with the central bank and government debt, I guess, mainly. It's sometimes people say, oh, well, all securities must be liquid, but I don't think the experience of the subprime crisis really showed that. We found that CDOs were highly illiquid, so I think they need a separate category. And, of course, this was thought to be a form of diversification at very high credit ratings when banks were holding them, but in fact they were very high risk, we know in retrospect, and capital was not sufficient because the credit ratings were wrong. But banks also have these things below the line nowadays, or at least they did till 2007, and one is the process of securitization, whereby loans will be securitized and made into illiquid securities, and of course those disappear from the balance sheet on a regular basis, as long as there is no what we call recourse. And that's always an issue which central bankers and regulators have worried about. Could securitized assets somehow come back on the balance sheet? But as we know, the much bigger risk was the one below, which was the other subsidiaries that banks developed, the SIVs and conduits. These were supposed to be separate from the bank's balance sheet. They were wholly financed by asset-backed commercial paper, but the problem for the bank is they had a backup line of credit. So in due course, when the ABCP market collapsed, back they went on the bank's balance sheet. So that's just to illustrate the issues that supervisors are facing as we go now into talking about the UK. So just to remind us what we can call microprudential regulation is all about, it's trying to protect against various market failures, and the one we've talked about mainly so far is externality, which is the risk of a systemic crisis due to bank runs. So we want to avoid bank failures that would cause the whole system to collapse. If it's an individual bank failure and it's not systemic, it's much more doubtful that we might want to prevent it, or at least we would not be so immediately rushing in. Information asymmetry, the uninformed depositor, and anyone who's being sold bank services, who doesn't really know the ins and outs, needs a form of protection. And of course, deposit insurance helps to protect the small depositor in most countries as well. And then the one that has been forgotten about quite often as well is monopoly. Regulation should be protecting the economy and the consumers, against excessive profit margins due to a monopolized banking system. Basically, in the UK, as we'll see, that was forgotten because of the externality trumped the monopoly when Lloyds was allowed to buy HBOS, which created a bank that is likely to have a form of excessive market power. And of course, the regulators are not the only players. Most countries have antitrust authorities or monopolies commissions who should be looking into this as well. And it's a question then of what the balance of power is between the antitrust authorities and the financial regulators. And a new player who is actually quite helpful, I think, is the European Commission, because the European Commission is now starting to say countries have been much too lax in terms of monopoly, allowing monopolies in their banking systems, and they're looking whether some of these things should be unpicked. Two aspects of regulation. The first one we've talked about yesterday pretty much, the safety net, what I call the current issue. I mean, it is starting to fade out, fortunately, now. The one we're mainly talking about now, though, is prudential supervision. As I showed you on the diagram, it's capital adequacy, supervisory monitoring. But also, as we'll talk in the next lecture, macroprudential surveillance. That's not our subject now, but it will be for most of the day. Any questions so far? Okay. Now, maybe you're all familiar, but I'll mention what the UK regulatory structure is. In the UK, we have what's called the tripartite system, which was set up in 1997 when the Bank of England lost financial regulation and the FSA, Financial Services Authority, was first set up. Supervisory power is shared between the Treasury, the FSA, and the Bank of England. And as it says here, they have specific roles within that. So the FSA is responsible for financial and banking regulation. They're the people who actually go and do the regulation. The Bank of England, as it says, is contributing to financial stability through its money market operations, through lender of last resort. And although the FSA does what we call a financial risk outlook, I think it's fair to say that the most authoritative view of financial system risk is the Bank of England's financial stability review. So that's your macroprudential surveillance. And then the Treasury is responsible, as it says, for the overall architecture of the system and anything to do with public finances. And they all meet up at least once a month at governor or alternate level in order to discuss various issues. So an example of that was what I told you about yesterday, the lender of last resort operation that came to light only a week or so ago. That took place back in October 2008 when the Bank of England rescued HBOS and the Royal Bank of Scotland with a £63 or £62 billion loan. So what would have happened then? Well, the FSA would have warned, given its knowledge of the banks, that things were very dangerous. The Bank of England would itself have had open ears because it has its money market and foreign exchange operations, which enable it to know exactly what's going on in the money market as well. The bank then lent, as I said, on $100 billion of collateral, and the Treasury would approve that transaction, and in this case we understand that the Treasury also guaranteed the bank. So you can see in that case how the three players were working together at a time of extreme crisis in the UK. For what was actually a very successful operation, given that those banks, although they had to be nationalised mostly, didn't collapse, which would have been catastrophic for the British financial system. On this diagram here that we move on to, I want to illustrate to you how important the banking sector is to the UK. And What I'm not showing, but I can tell you and you're probably aware, is that financial sector is enormously important to the whole economy as well. The number I'm not sure of, but it's around 20% of GDP comes from the financial sector. And so what you can see here is how very, very large the banking sector is relative to in the euro area and especially in the United States. In the US, of course, there's a lot of securitization, so that bypasses banks. Equally, the volume of interbank trade in the US, I think, is quite a lot lower. Those are two among many explanations of why US bank assets are only one times GDP. UK is 5.5. And, of course, that 5.5 is not solely devoted to lending to the UK household and corporate sectors. It's the international banking sector in London which is accounting for a lot of that. And you can kind of see that when you see this diagram at the bottom here. What you can see there is that sterling assets amount to maybe 2.5 times GDP, whereas the foreign currency assets account for 3 times GDP. And the foreign currency assets are generally not domestic. They are assets which are held in London but which are lent to foreigners. British companies and households don't borrow in foreign currency much unless it's a company with an international operation. And what you can also see here, of course, is the enormous presence of other banking sectors in the UK as well. So the UK banks themselves are only 2.5 times GDP. Other banks, other EU are 1.5, American a half, Japanese, other developed, another 1 times GDP, etc. So we're talking a very internationalized banking system, but equally we are saying that we've got a very large, this is still pretty large in my view, especially if you compare it with that, or this even, the sterling assets are large compared with the US. So there is still a very substantial financial sector serving the British economy as well, directly. These are some indicators taken from the OECD chapter. FSIs, you're probably familiar with the term. I mean the IMF expression, financial soundness indicators. I tend to prefer the expression macroprudential indicators, but anyway, it says FSIs there. And just looking at this very quickly, what can we see? Well, we can see that the median Tier 1 ratio had fallen somewhat between 2003 and 2007. So that's a little warning, maybe not a huge one. It's certainly quite a good Tier 1 ratio, I think, compared with some other countries. But this is more the danger signal. The leverage, this is leverage, as I said yesterday, in its true sense. This is the number of times capital is covered, the number of times assets are of capital, had been rising quite considerably. Okay, so this is showing that UK banks, like many others, had been loading up on what were so-called AAA securitized debt, and therefore their assets were growing faster than their capital. And this is a pretty high leverage ratio, in my opinion, 30 times. And it, as you see in 2008, it went up to 34 times as the crisis really hit. So this is, if you like, the reciprocal of the unweighted capital adequacy. This is the weighted capital adequacy, right? Non-performing loans, this is what always happens in a boom. You get fooled by the fact that there aren't many non-performing loans out there. You think everything's fine. And yes, non-performing loans have been pretty low. Haven't got the data here when this was published, but they'd already started to rise. Provisions had fallen back. This is the counterpart. This is the showing, if you like, the fact that the UK, like everybody else except the Spanish, didn't have a system of counter-cyclical provisioning. We allowed provisions to fall back during the boom because, well, there aren't many non-performing loans, are there? So just let's wait until they come along. That's the usual approach of supervision. That in the second lecture we'll talk about the challenges that are now being posed. This was pretty worrying as well. The return on assets had fallen since 2005. Already in 2007 was only 0.4. And equally the return on equity had peaked out in 2005. And therefore there was things going on that one might have been concerned about at that point. And this is a chart that the Bank of England have been showing a lot, especially since the crisis. And this is the illustration of what I was saying yesterday, and repeatedly, if you like, the customer deposit to loan ratio. A corollary of a bank that wants to raise loans more than customer deposits is you've got to get the money from somewhere else. And this is the bank's indicator of that, what they call the customer funding gap. The difference, that is, between customer loans and customer deposits. When I say customer, I mean basically UK households, companies, and maybe other financial. Yeah. And what you can see basically is that in 2000, the UK banks were in balance, but they then built up this enormous requirement for wholesale funding, basically, from wherever they could lay their hands on it, and quite a lot of it from other banks abroad. So this is the UK bank's exposure to the international interbank market that, as we saw yesterday, is a pretty shaky source of long-term funding. Any questions there at all? Okay, so we talked about the crisis in general terms yesterday. Here are some specific features of the crisis that that we had in the UK. In common with the Eurozone and the United States, the interbank market became, I say, frozen, at least much more difficult to get anything except overnight funding right from August 2007. So the Bank of England started providing liquidity assistance. It wasn't immediate. There was a little concern about what was going on, but eventually they did so. We had the retail and customer run on and wholesale run on Northern Rock that, again, I talked about already. And that was after an attempt at lender of last resort had backfired and led to the greater public concern. Other banks that had to be taken over included Bradford and Bingley and Alliance and Leicester. And a particularly interesting feature of the United States is that we had these building societies, right, which are housing finance institutions. And the sector was quite a large one, and it was what we call mutual. Yeah, I guess you have mutual banks here, meaning, in other words, there aren't shareholders. They're owned by the depositors. They started off as a sort of self-help thing in communities, basically. And they grew a lot because the UK people love to buy and sell houses to each other. It's a national pastime. Basically, in the Thatcher years, I think, it was permitted for these building societies to demutualize. In other words, they were allowed to change from mutual ownership to shareholder ownership. And because people love short-term gains, everyone got really excited about this because they thought, what we can do is if we've got a mortgage or a deposit, we can all vote and say we want to become a public limited company and we'll get some money, right? So except for one, which is called the Nationwide, which is a very fine institution, all of the big building societies did this. They demutualized, and people got maybe £500, as I did as well for one of them, I forgot which one it was. You get a bit of money, and then it gets sold off as in shareholders. And what's interesting is that these banks have been the worst performing institutions in the UK. Okay, so Bradford and Bingley, Alliance and Leicester, Northern Rock, Halifax, these are all ex-building societies, and all of them basically made huge errors in their credit risk assessment before the crisis, because they had changed their ethos from a mutual prudent institution to one that was trying to perform, perform like a bank, get a high return for the shareholders, but they didn't have the history and the depth of credit culture that long-established banks like Lloyd's and Barclays and HSBC had. I'm not saying the banks were perfect either, because, as we know, Royal Bank of Scotland also fell in a hole. But it is very noticeable, and I think that's an interesting thing to watch out for, that institutions that have changed their ownership structure and have different objectives, by UK evidence, are very unstable and fragile, and certainly that's what we saw in the UK. So after the collapse of Lehman's, Royal Bank of Scotland and HBOS is the combination of Halifax, that was a building society, and Bank of Scotland, which was a bank, had to be both nationalised and recapitalised and given massive lend from last resort. This number I wouldn't trust. I think it's much larger. That was an early estimate from the Bank of England. Losses, I think, are probably in three figures by now. Initially mainly US securities, the famous CDOs, but later and now increasingly UK defaults. And I think to some extent the worst fears about housing losses have not occurred yet, partly because the interest rate is so low that people can more or less afford their mortgages despite falling house prices and the recession. Also, unemployment has not risen as much as was feared. On the other hand, there will come a time when the interest rate has to rise. That may lead to more housing losses. And equally, commercial property looks very risky, and there are big exposures to that. So they're not out of the woods yet. And as we saw on the diagram, many losses are due to the SIVs and conduits, and the size of them surprised the regulators. Which kind of surprises me, but that is mentioned in the OECD report. And we've had a serious collapse of the real economy. Out of the G7, the UK has been the hardest hit. It's still in recession, whereas France, Germany, etc. have come out of it. And we can relate that, of course, not just to banking, but to the leverage of the household and corporate sectors, that as we saw on that diagram yesterday, the households especially have got one of the highest debt to income ratios in the OECD, and that's holding back consumption despite the low interest rates. Any questions? Okay, so what I'm trying to do, if you like, is give you lessons from the UK experience that could be helpful, as well as drawing in some general policy issues that I hope are interesting too. And Northern Rock failure, I think, is one that is particularly interesting to look at. And the FSA admit themselves that this was not their finest hour. In fact, they have written a very, very, how should we put it, a very, very frank report by their auditors, which is well worth a look actually. It's referenced in the OECD paper. A frank report by their auditors on how badly they made mistakes in Northern Rock. So this is just a few points from that report. And, you know, if you're a supervisor, then it's very salutary to have a look at that and see, you know, what issues you might be falling into. Northern Rock had quite a lot of asset risk. It did make some very aggressive mortgages. When I say 125%, that means they would give a loan-to-value of 125%. But mainly it was the liability risk, the high dependence on wholesale funding that brought it down, because it was relying on securitization, it was relying on wholesale funding. Securitization collapsed in August 2007. Wholesale funding was much harder to get, and so it basically ran out of money. And why didn't the supervisor say there's something a bit wrong here, especially because Northern Rock was a very aggressive bank? It was growing very quickly. It was trying to grow at an incredible pace compared with the rest of the financial system. And I think basically what the FSA admit themselves is they got complacent about it. So Northern Rock had the longest regulatory periods between the arrow is basically the sort of, how should we call it, it's the deep assessment that goes right up to board level in the FSA, right? So periodically any supervisory institution will go deeply into an institution and say, you know, what are the risks, what sort of things do we need to worry about? And they decided that it only needed one of those every 3 years, which is really long. It had the lowest number of close and continuous surveillance meetings. Those are the inter-arrow meetings. And it was the only high-impact firm without a risk mitigation program, which is another form of inter-assessment monitoring. And that despite the fact that, you know, any bank economist could have said that rapid growth is likely to be risky from adverse selection in terms of the borrowers you're getting, but also because of the volatility of wholesale funding. Northern Rock was also moved between FSA divisions 3 times in as many years, so that's obviously going to disrupt the continuity of supervision. And the division responsible for Northern Rock had suffered staff cuts as well. So often they didn't even keep records of the supervisory meetings. So this is a lot of serious mistakes that they had made. And the worst, another one is particularly bad, is this one at the bottom here. Despite knowing all about the fact that the was a quite a risky liability side, very rapid asset growth, they firstly allowed it to pay a very large dividend in spring 2007, but secondly, to reduce its capital adequacy target, because it had apparently met the advanced IRB, you know, the Basel II internal modelling standard. So they were ready to let it reduce its capital adequacy target, even though, as it says, they were already concerned about liquidity. So basically those are some big issues. As I said yesterday, Northern Rock also raised a lot of big issues about deposit insurance. We got rid of co-insurance as a consequence. It also, I think, taught a lot about lender of last resort, because it showed that lender of last resort is best done covertly rather than overtly, I think. Lessons for the safety net in the UK. Firstly, there's a major burden on fiscal policy from the recapitalisation. The UK is in a very bad fiscal situation at the moment because, firstly, the cost of the banking issue. I would estimate maybe 10 or 15% of GDP, the bank issues alone. There are some very large numbers floating around at the moment from the government auditor, like 850 billion, but I think those numbers are not just covering money that's disappeared, if you like, or money that's been spent, but it also covers guarantees, which are also, which probably won't be called, but it's still very expensive. The reason the UK is in a fiscal mess, though, is not just the banking recapitalisation. It's also the fact that previously, in the boom, it had much too loose a fiscal position. The government had been relying perhaps excessively on taxes from the financial system, as well as allowing expenditure to be growing too rapidly. The government also made a statement that it wanted lending to the private sector to be maintained, which was a pretty unrealistic suggestion. I think they're still not lending much to companies. The question there, as some of us were discussing yesterday, is if you see low lending, is it really supply or is it demand? Probably in the UK there is supply constraint on lending to companies, though, which of course is of concern because you could lose productive capacity unnecessarily. Public support for recapitalisation. I think the big debate this week that you may have heard about on bankers' bonuses, the UK actually decided yesterday, I think, to put some sort of tax on the banks' bonuses, is partly linked to this point that they think that the banks have received all this money from them and here they are waltzing off with £1 million bonuses. It doesn't look too good up in Barnsley and Huddersfield, so those are gritty northern towns, by the way, where there aren't many people getting £1 million bonuses. So I think there's a political element there. And then there's the poor performance of public banks globally, which is a key issue, I think, looking forwards, that the government realised they can't run public banks. They can't run banks. What they're trying to do is have them at arm's length and sell them off as quickly as possible. And that leads to an interesting conflict. If you want to control the bonuses, especially of the banks that you're holding, then basically you are you may be reducing the equity value of those banks if they lose all their best people. So there's an interesting conflict there. UK deposit insurance, I won't spend much time on that, but there is a reform. Firstly, the emergency thing was a rise in the amount and the percentage. The new system is being introduced, and the plan is that you should get your money in 7 days, and the banks say that this is virtually impossible, which is quite interesting because it's the rule in the US and they do manage it. So that's something they'll have to put up with. There's a big discussion on pre-funding, which I talk about in the OECD paper, that I think there's a strong argument that we should pre-fund deposit insurance during the upturn. The issue, I suppose, is when you introduce it, would it be wrong to introduce pre-funding now? And should there be risk-based premium, I'm strongly in favour of them, given the arguments we had yesterday about the need to reduce moral hazard in deposit insurance. Risk-based premium will definitely help that. I think the UK authorities are worried that if a bank gets a downgrade on its risk-based premium, then that may cause it to suffer a run. On the other hand, the Americans and the Canadians, etc., seem to have a system of risk-based premium that doesn't do that. So I'm not convinced. Any questions at that point?
Can I ask if there was this big funded system, are there any discussions what would be the target?
The target for?
The target, how large should be the fund compared to the deposits that they're charging?
That's a good question. No, I'm not sure about that. Yeah, I would have thought 10 or 20% maybe, but that's an awful lot, of course, given you've got an international banking system and 5.5 times GDP. So yeah, that's a good question, if I have any ideas on that. And I'll recheck what was said in here. I'll let you know later. But yeah, clearly you would have to think about that. Anyone else? Okay. Lender of last resort, I think, has been overburdened. The Bank of England did have to struggle along on its own for quite a long time. It's had to grow its balance sheet to 15% of GDP, which is not something I imagine it's very happy with. Covert lending we've talked about after the failure with Northern Rock. The issue now is how do you get rid of the high level of liquidity support that you have now, and have we really dealt with the stigma that is the issue that Northern Rock was seen as needing support and that led to a run? There has been some reform introducing standing facilities in the UK that weren't there before that may help to deal with that. And this is there's been several important reforms in the UK already because of these crises. The first one is deposit insurance. There's also, as I say, Bank of England liquidity facilities, but a very important one is the special resolution regime. Another big lesson of Northern Rock was that you can't allow a bank to go through the normal corporate liquidation procedure in a financial crisis, or it's not very desirable to do that, because a normal corporate liquidation procedure is a very protracted process. All the claimants on the firm have got to have their own arguments. A smaller number of creditors may be able to block a successful resolution, a purchase by someone else. There are all sorts of difficulties that basically, once Northern Rock collapsed and was taken over by the state, it took an inordinate time to actually resolve it. And the authorities realized that this was no good for banks. We had to have a special resolution regime. And I think that Sweden may well have been a model for looking at that. I think they have a decent special resolution regime. Your supervisors will know about that. Basically, the idea, as I say, is that you put a bank into resolution when it's not technically insolvent, and that enables the authorities to sell it off to someone else when the net worth has not gone below zero. Okay, but an issue, again, I think, for the UK is that they love judgmentalism. They like to be able to have discretion. Which does have something going for it, I agree, but my own preference would be that the trigger for that sort of intervention should be something that people can see. So I would be in favour of the American system of prompt corrective action targets, that when capital or liquidity get to a certain critical point, then it becomes a presumption that a bank would go into this special resolution system, and that would then avoid forbearance, allowing the institution to carry on until it gets a very destructive. Another issue is the Bank of England. It seems to be the one that's got all the work to do in this area, and if it actually had to resolve, say, six banks at once, I could see it becoming overburdened. So that's another issue that the special resolution regime has to face. And if you want to catch up with some of these issues, there's been some excellent work by the Treasury Select Committee, as well as by the Treasury itself, that summarised the discussions of these policies that were quite radical for the UK. Let's talk about prudential regulation, the micro level. Capital adequacy basically didn't prevent the crisis. And my argument, which is accepted, but the general argument, I think, is that we realised that risk-adjusted capital adequacy wasn't accurate and it wasn't sufficient. Okay, it wasn't accurate because of the subsidiaries that hadn't been realised would come back on the balance sheet, the SIVs and the conduits, and it wasn't sufficient because the growth of balance sheets was very great, as you saw from the leverage leverage by the customer funding. So there's some rethinking needed. And one point I make in the OECD paper is that in the UK, as we'll see in one of the later lectures, we have what's called the trigger ratio system. The trigger ratio is, I think, a big advance. It's had it for many years, right? Is a big advance on Basel I. Because Basel I, you say everyone needs 8% capital and forget about anything else. It's long as they've got 8, everyone's happy. In the UK, they've always maintained a higher level of capital than TRIC, than Basel, depending on their view of the bank's risk, which is called the trigger ratio. What worries me is that the trigger ratio is not published, so no one really knows whether a bank's capital is adequate in the eyes of the regulators. So in my view, that would be good to be published, as well as the a lot more about the intermediate assessments of the banks. The balances between market discipline, which I'm in favour of, which would justify that sort of thing, publication, and the idea that there should be confidentiality with supervisors, that they're, you know, that there should be that there might be bad market reactions and stuff like that. So that's a first issue in capital adequacy. And the second one is, of course, that we need to sort out the off-balance sheet risks, because the SIVs and conduits were basically a blind spot for the supervisors in setting the capital. And that's a question, firstly, of capital adequacy, but also accounting for the off-balance sheet. And the off-balance sheet is partly resolved, I think, by the move from Basel 1 to Basel 2, because Basel 2 is a lot better at detecting off-balance sheet exposures. But that assumes that you actually find out exactly what they are, I would say. And basically, the UK is aiming for higher capital across the board, and I'm going to show you a lecture later on this afternoon where, at the National Institute, we did some research for the FSA on what would be the impact of higher capital. And, of course, higher capital is desirable because it makes it less likely that the banking system collapses. And that's a general discussion around the world, of course. But the UK wants to, the FSA are very keen to do that. The downside is it raises the cost of intermediation, because banks with a higher capital charge are likely to want a wider margin between loan deposit rates to compensate. And we'll talk about that later. There's a lot of discussion on pro-cyclicality. That's in the lecture after this, where the Spanish approach, which again we'll talk about later, but basically the Spanish, as you may know, they build up provisions during the upturn. So going back to this one, in Spain, rather than these provisions falling from 70% to 54%, they would probably have maintained or even increased during the upturn. That would have been the way the Spanish would have dealt with that situation. And we can see in the UK that we should have done that as well. So a lot of discussion there. And then the leverage ratio, or the unweighted capital adequacy ratio, let's call it, also is important, as well as the Basel risk adjusted. Any questions at that point? Okay, so capital adequacy problems there, but I think liquidity is even worse. Liquidity regulation had been forgotten, and the UK is trying to catch up with that very rapidly. The FSA have come up with a discussion paper, which is a very aggressive discussion paper on liquidity. Basically, as it says there, they're going to demand that the banks hold 5 to 10% of their assets as government bonds, which will be a very large increase and will reduce the revenue of the banks quite considerably, because the government bonds obviously yield a lot less than loans do. And like the trigger ratios, what the FSA have in mind is the bank will have an individual target for liquidity. It's what they call the individual liquidity adequacy standards. That's a counterpart to trigger ratios, adequacy standards, a counterpart to trigger ratios for liquidity. So the UK are very much alive to the need to get back all the ground that they ceded on liquidity and make sure that banks actually hold the stuff. Things of concern. The UK regulation always has an issue lurking in the cupboard, which is, well, if we tighten on our own, what happens to the city as an international financial centre? And this is also an issue to do with the bankers' bonus taxation that I told you about as well. So that's one that they would much rather have an international agreement if possible, I think. Maybe there's a need for an aggregate quantitative target across the system as well, sort of macro-prudential liquidity. And it's crucial that we need to keep an eye on liability management and not just on the asset side. You know, you could envisage a rise in asset side liquidity, but then supposing the banks raise their proportion of wholesale funding at the same time is not much use. In fairness, the UK do envisage doing that as well, but it's important that that is done. And other prudential regulation had let banks take unwarranted risks. The loan-to-value ratio that I told you about for Northern Rock was not unusual. Other banks were very aggressive on lending. They lent particularly on what we call buy-to-let. Buy-to-let has been one of the disaster areas of the financial crisis in the UK. Buy-to-let, as you would realise, is people who already have a home buy another one so they can rent it out. Okay, and they thought, as long as we get the rent, it'll cover the mortgage because the mortgage rate is quite low. Came the recession, the buy-to-let loans were hugely non-performing. The levels of non-performance in buy-to-let loans was very, very high. And that was why Bradford and Bingley, Alliance and Leicester, etc., collapsed, because they had lots of, and I think Northern Rock to some extent, but less so, they had lots of lending to buy-to-let, and people don't have the same incentive to pay their buy-to-let if they don't have a tenant than they do if it's their own home that they're going to lose and they'll be out on the streets. So people just defaulted on buy-to-let very, very widely. So limits on loan-to-value should be particularly tailored to that problem we've had. Ensuring remuneration covers the lifetime of products, that's to do with short-term bonuses, and in my view, the targeting of bankers' bonuses as a sort of envy politics approach, which we seem to be having at the moment, is not the right thing. What we should be doing is leaning on banks via the financial regulator to restructure the way that bonuses are paid, so that they are paid over the lifetime of products, you know. That's the real issue, in my opinion. If you only reward people for last year's performance, they might have been taking huge risks that leads the institution into a crisis, or they might have been buying institutions like RBS did, ABN AMRO, that leads to problems as well. So yeah, that's my view on that. Is there a need to divide commercial and investment banking, reduce bank size? Those things have been discussed, and the reduction in bank size could be related to what we call cross-sectional macro-prudential regulation, and we'll talk about that in the next lecture. Mervyn King has certainly been quite radical in discussing these issues. People talk about separating out the casino element of banking, which is a slightly exaggerated way of talking about proprietary trading from traditional banking, you know, lending and taking deposits, and why are we guaranteeing casinos, which I think is very political and somewhat unnecessary language, but never mind. But yeah, those issues are around. Caution in government guaranteeing securitisation. There's an issue at the moment, as you are aware, of the death of the securitisation market. And as I was mentioning, if you're interested in that, the IMF's Global Financial Stability Report for October has got a chapter on how to get the thing going. In the UK, there's been some discussion whether we should have government guarantees of securitized loans. I think that could be quite risky. Look at what happened in the United States. And finally, other prudential could discuss regulation of innovations. Because basically, CDOs, etc., had been introduced without, let's say, without any awareness of what they might do in a downturn, and without any awareness, perhaps, of the incentive structure that, in the end, generated the toxic assets out of what was supposed to be AAA loans. And Ray Barrell and I have argued that one way that financial innovations could be addressed is to say they should be tested out like drugs. You don't allow a drug to be used by individuals, given the harm it might do, without a huge amount of testing and proof that it's not going to kill people or cause deformities or whatever. But we let financial innovations get introduced without any such testing. So that's an interesting question, I think. Should we be a lot more careful about financial innovations, that they have to prove that they're not harmful before they're introduced? And regulators have not been doing that in the UK or anywhere else, I don't think, to the extent they should have done. Any thoughts or questions there?
I just thought that it's like they're going back to the times of John Law.
Yes. What, that we want to go back to simple banking?
No, I know what you mean.
You mean the French Ponzi scheme? Yes.
And then maybe it was sort of innovation, which, or because you said that nowadays everything is done, or most of the things are done like John Law said should be done, but then just. People were afraid of that, and it was also an innovation which created the scheme.
Well, John Law, just to explain, I guess, does everyone know about John Law? Was the guy who basically bankrupted the French state, wasn't he, in the early 18th century by introducing all these clever financial innovations? I see the point. As I said earlier, the Bank of England, as well as the FSA, produced macroprudential analyses, but they didn't really warn about the crisis. And even when they were, there's the issue of what you do about them. We'll talk about that in the next lecture. My argument would be that we have to make sure the macroprudential considerations enter the individual supervisory discussions, as well as supervision. That I'm sure it happens to some extent, but I'm sure it will be done a lot more carefully from now on. The UK was always supportive of what they called a light touch regulation, but they said, you know, we let banks get on with their business, but we make sure that their processes in particular are adequate. And that, of course, is the background to Basel II. Basel II for complex and capable banks were supposed to indeed verify processes and let them get on with it. But I think the UK are on the back foot now. The light touch failed with Northern Rock, and the risky lending, the wholesale funding, and assessment of takeovers, particularly ABN AMRO that I mentioned, mean that perhaps the UK needs to tighten up, and there are already signs of that, with the desire to get more capital, the desire to have individual liquidity assessment. The UK is moving much more to rules than it was before. Structure of regulation, I would argue we need more dual key. The Bank of England and FSA, for example, looking at institutions at the same time to avoid underlap, which is a horrible expression, but you know what I mean. Underlap means that you have gaps, overlap means that you're both doing the same thing, so you avoid underlap. Very, very horrible expression. Don't learn it in English. It's not good for your English. It's, although you probably hear it when you go to Basel, so, you know. Or maybe even moving the LCFIs back to the bank, large, complex financial institutions. And we kill more on that in a second. Cross-border aspects. How far ahead can the UK go alone? We're thinking here about the international financial system. The UK wants to remain the Europe's global financial centre. And that's a big issue, I think. Does the city concern dilute desirable regulation? Basel II, this is not just a problem for the UK, obviously. Do we go back to the drawing board? Rating agencies are now discredited, but they're core to Basel II. Risk models are somewhat discredited as well. They're core to Basel II. That's a problem for all the central banks, not just the UK. Why can't we get an agreement on liquidity in Basel? That needs to be done. And then there's Iceland, which I haven't mentioned yet, which was a very interesting topic in the UK. I have to say that although I didn't do anything about it, I saw these huge posters on the railway station saying, put your money with Icesave and get 7% interest, when the highest UK bank would be 5.5 or 6. And I always thought, there's something dangerous here. But we didn't really know how dangerous it was until, as you know, the Icelandic banks blew up, basically. And that raises not just an issue for the UK. In the UK, the Icelanders were pretty angry about the use of the anti-terror law to seize assets, but basically, I suppose the UK used their whatever powers they could use against this terrible little country that argues with us about, argues with us about fish as well. I'm not saying that was a good thing at all, but the big issue, I think, is this one here, that the institutions in Iceland had grown to be too big to save. They were too big for the capacity of the fiscal authorities to rescue them. And that, to me, is a problem in Switzerland, and it could be a problem in the UK. We were just about able to save our HBOS and RBS. Could we really have saved Lloyds, HSBC and Barclays as well? Interesting question. So the too big to save issue is something key to learn about in prudential regulation. But the other one is this branching and cross-border lender of last resort, and that's an Eastern European issue as well. I think the Icelandic banks had branched into the UK because they're in the EEA, even though they're not in the EU, and that was perfectly allowed. But that, I think, from the supervisor's point of view, is a matter of concern because they didn't realise how risky those banks were, and they didn't have the levers anyway to do much about them. And that's an issue, of course, right across Eastern Europe as well. Broader cross-border issues of home and host, which in Eastern Europe are very important, as I mentioned. There's been two important developments since that OECD report, more than two, but at least two. One is the FSA's own proclamation about what it thinks the future is, which is called the Turner Review. Turner is the head of the FSA, just come in, he's a very dynamic character. That just a couple points there, they're very negative on market discipline, and what they point to is that if you look at CDS spreads in mid-2007, they weren't telling us anything about risks. It was only when the crisis actually happened that the CDS spreads did anything. So they're kind of doubtful about market discipline, which I think is kind of unfortunate. Maybe the markets need a bit more information as well. They talk about the boundary problem. This is a concept that Charles Goodhart talks about, which is related to the fact that if you regulate a certain area of the financial system, then intermediation shifts outside that area, right? Intermediation always moves out. Examples, the Japanese non-bank banks we talked about. Another example is the UK's SIVs, conduits, as well as other countries. How do you regulate the unregulated? That was discussed in this context as well. Do we need international institutional cooperation in macroprudential surveillance between the FSA and the bank? What are we going to do with the new EU regulator? We had a chat about that, some of us at lunch, the EU's new institutions. My understanding is that they might be quite toothless. But in a sense, I think the crisis is saying that there is a need for an EU dimension to supervision. Because of the cross-border nature of banking within the EU. Desire for cross-border, the FSA are very keen on getting rid of branches in the wake of the Iceland situation. They want to have nothing but subsidiaries, which I think is probably quite a sensible idea. But that might require a treaty change, so it's not going to be straightforward. But after that came another bombshell when the Conservatives, who seem likely to win the next election, said that they want prudential supervision to go back to the Bank of England from the FSA. So that's thrown the whole board game up in the air. Here's just a few comments on that. Does the Bank of England really want to regulate banks? As a monetary authority that is doing independent banking, independent inflation targeting, is there a possible conflict with banking supervision? And wouldn't it be rather better to have someone else doing it? That's an important question, I think, about costs. Would it be better for the bank to have macroprudential levers that we'll talk about after the coffee break? Is there a kind of middle ground where the bank doesn't have to take over this whole set of people doing regulation? What the FSA at the moment is a kind of coherent institution, a very large one, but they have a whole range of microprudential under their roof. What sort of institution would it be if it was only doing customer protection? And what sort of transition dangers could there be? So that might well happen. There are arguments both ways. The argument that a central bank that's doing lender of last resort, it's good for it to supervise. That's something that people like the Dutch and the Spanish would certainly support. On the other hand, possible conflicts with monetary policy, or at least perceived conflicts, are things that I think the bank would worry about as well. Any thoughts or questions on that? What do you see as a key issue in microprudential regulation in this country? Anyone?
What does it mean, macro?
I mean regulation as of individual institutions.
You probably know that.
It's owned by the Swedes, yeah.
We have the biggest ratio of foreign banks in Europe.
Right.
It's 98%. It's the biggest issue is supervisory wallet.
Supervisory
policies.
Right. Mm-hmm. So in the sense of the supervisors who are here, or worrying about the home supervisors as well?
It's just the cooperation.
Yeah.
You understand the...
Of course.
Problems of both sides. So
and
we must understand home supervisors.
Yeah, and do you feel that's satisfactory at the moment?
With Swedes, I feel it's satisfactory, yes.
Okay. And they are virtually all of the 98? They're most of the 98? Or are there other countries who own banks here?
Denmark.
Okay.
And Finland maybe also, but
mm-hmm.
It's also through the Stockholm. So Swedish are the key players.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Do you think Estonia would be in favour of more host leverage over institutions, or are they kind of content with the way things are?
I think market should decide it. It's not our...
No, I mean, that's not a market question. It's saying what power does the home, as opposed to the host, have over branches and subsidiaries? All I'm saying is, do you think it would be good to have more leverage, or are you happy with basically the regulation being run from Copenhagen and Stockholm?
For us, I think in the future it might be that all the banks here are branches. So we probably foresee much more power in the region of branches.
You would like more power, yeah, okay. Or what do you think of mandatory subsidiarization? You think branches are still okay?
For
the safety net, it would be better, because then you would have devoted capital, wouldn't you, to your institutions. I mean, I think there's a single market issue there as well, of course, that if everyone is obliged to subsidiarize, then the single market in financial services is not so strong, is it?
But maybe to avoid the accumulation of risks, then it is better to have some power.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking, yeah, yeah.
Basically, it's just to make the substitute exogenous shocks from endogenous ones in a way that it's not existing, and create its own shocks as well.
Yes, that's true, although they're still vulnerable to...
This is already a macroprudential issue.
You are doing macroprudential, I agree, yeah, your financial... I'm just trying to get a feel for how you think the issues are in micro, you know, the individual banks. I mean, there's a separate institution some of you are with. Is that from the bank, or is it in the bank?
FSA is separate.
Yeah, that's right. Is someone from the FSA? You are from the FSA. So, yeah. And for the moment, that's the structure that has that. How long has that been in operation?
7 years.
7 years.
You mean
the separate FSA?
It started from 2002.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and you do insurance and stuff as well.
Yeah.
All right.
All the market.
Right. Okay. Okay, well, we'll return to that. Should I suggest we have a coffee break then, and come back at past, and we'll see what we can fit in.